So how do we know a good idea is really a good idea for First Nations children and families? Or that that good idea actually works in the diverse and distinct First Nations communities all over this country? Let's dig a little deeper and chat with experts in the field of child well-being about what the evidence says, what are some of the myths, and what works when it comes to supporting First Nations children, young people, and their families. You're listening to Season 2 of Spirit Bearers Ask an Expert podcast. So hello, everyone, and welcome to Spirit Bears Podcast. That's right, PAWcast, where we talk to experts about things that we've heard about in child and family services, but we maybe want to do a deeper dive in understanding what they are. I did line work for about 15 years. And one of the things we do in child welfare is we have to look at the ability of parents to be able to parent children in a safe and loving way. And there's something called parenting capacity assessments. And that's what we're going to delve into today. I am joining you from unceded and unsurrendered territories of the Musqueam, the Tsleil-Waututh, and the Squamish Nations here in Vancouver today. And I want to recognize all of the territories where you are joining us from. Today, we have three very special guests to join us to unpack this whole question of parenting assessments. What are they? What do we know about them? Do they actually work? Are they based on kind of white parents and not really the First Nations parents? We're going to go through all these kinds of questions with an amazing panel with Dr. Fallon, who's a University of Toronto's Associate Vice President of Research, with Dr. Ashley Vandermorris, who's a staff pediatrician at SickKids, and with Genevieve Saison, who's a research associate at the University of Toronto. Thank you all very much for joining us today. We're going to begin with the question, a big question, because it is a bit of a mouthful. Like, I don't know why we come up with these long descriptions that just, I just don't always understand what they mean. And it's parenting capacity assessment. So what is it, Dr. Fallon?
Thank you, Cindy. And on behalf of Ashley and Genevieve, thank you for having us on Spirit Bears podcast. We are honored to be his guests and yours. So agreed, it is a mouthful, parenting capacity assessment, but I guess the best way to think of it is that it's basically a tool that is typically used in child welfare cases to evaluate the needs of children and the parents' abilities or capacity to meet those needs. So a request for the tool is basically made by a child welfare authority, and that's after a determination that the child is in need of protection or at risk of harm, where there are some issues or challenges around the parent's ability to parent. They really can be used at any stage in a child welfare case. Once the court has determined that there's a parenting capacity assessment needed, someone is appointed to conduct the actual assessment. And typically that person is paid by a child welfare authority. And usually that person is a mental health professional, such as a psychologist or a psychiatrist. The actual assessment can take different forms, but usually it means that the parent is being interviewed or the child. There's some observation around the parent-child interaction, and there's some other questionnaires involved. And then after all that's done, a report is prepared and presented to the court as expert testimony.
So basically these things are, do I, as a parent, have the ability to care for a child in a safe and healthy way? Is that what they're really after?
Exactly. In that moment, they're making a determination about that very question based on this process. Exactly.
You know, one of the things I'm thinking about as you're talking about these parenting assessments is, say if I'm a parent of a 9-year-old and I've been doing a pretty okay job, but I'm going through a rough patch in my life in the last couple of months. And this parenting assessment happens during one of those rough patches. Does it take into account the fact that I've actually been an okay parent all the rest of this time and I just need some help to get through this difficulty that I'm having?
That's a really good point, Cindy. And it kind of raises questions around the definitions of parenting capacity. Parenting capacity is supposed to be defined as the ability of the parent to adequately parent in the long term or on an ongoing basis. So it's not meant to capture, you know, whether they had a bad day in the moment that the assessment is being done, or just, you know, these short term challenges that they're experiencing. It's meant to be, you know, a larger assessment over a longer period of time. However, what we're finding in the literature and what researchers are saying is that this definition is, it can be really open to interpretation. It's largely a clinical judgment. And there isn't really, you know, a formal or commonly accepted definition or understanding of what it really means to be a good enough parent. So that's kind of some of the issues around these parenting capacity assessments that we'll talk about.
Like, I mean, if I'm being assessed, against what standard is my question, right? And for First Nations folks, we've had this weaponized against us time and time again, where the federal government has said, well, you can't properly care for your kids, which really meant you need to make them like our kids, take away everything that they are about First Nations, Métis, and Inuit, and put them in places like residential schools and child welfare and other placements. Were these assessments, is this standard we're measuring First Nations parents and others against, was it based on research about First Nations parents, or are we talking about standards that were created for somebody else and now are just being applied to our First Nations parents?
You're summarizing exactly the main critique of existing parenting capacity assessments. They really are based on a Eurocentric approach to understanding family and child rearing practices, and they're not rooted in culturally relevant science with any consideration around First Nation Métis knowledge, culture, and practices. So as a result, the same standards cannot be applied to the assessment of First Nation, Métis, and Inuit parents in meaningful ways. So just for an example, the Eurocentric approach to understanding the family really defines it as a nuclear unit, which consists of parents and children. That's pretty much in stark contrast to family systems among First Nation, Métis, and Inuit populations, which are really based in general on extended family structures and a shared collective responsibility that the larger community has for children.
And in our previous episodes, we were talking about the things that are actually putting First Nations families at risk. And we know this from your work, Dr. Fallon, and from the work of the First Nations Advisory Committee on the Canadian Incident Study on Reported Child Abuse and Neglect, that there are things like poverty, poor housing, caregiver substance misuse, domestic violence. All of these things have roots back in residential schools and the ongoing kind of colonization. Do these tools, when they're applied, do they take account of that? That a lot of these things are beyond your ability to control. You're just a victim of all this stuff. And so you're starting at a place of greater hardship than maybe my neighbor next door who hasn't gone through any of that.
I'm in complete agreement. I think that something that my dear friend and colleague Cindy Blackstock always says is that the structural issues are often codified at an individual level, and individuals are held accountable for structural pieces that are not in their purview to change. And so certainly some of the impacts of parenting really have direct roots and causes in colonial structures. And so the parenting capacity assessment, by definition, is really looking at that parent and the relationship with the child without necessarily considering those structural pieces that are very challenging to impact.
And Dr. Vandermorris, I mean, you must encounter this in your practice where you've got parents of all different diversities coming forward, different socioeconomic experiences, different cultural experiences. And you also have a population of children that have different needs. Some of these children have higher needs, which would put more demands on the parent than, say, you know, your run-of-the-mill child. And not to say that run-of-the-mill parenting isn't a challenge, it is, but what does this actually look like when you're interacting with a family? And do you think these parenting capacity assessments have a role? And if so, what is it? And what are the safeguards against things that Genevieve and Barbara are talking about?
You're absolutely right. I mean, each child has their own needs and strengths and, you know, presents their own challenges to the parents. I mean, that's the reality of parenting. And the job of a parent is to try their best to meet those needs. But I think what Barbara and Genevieve have been alluding to and you know, the limitation of the parenting capacities is that really they seem to suggest that the full response needs to come directly from the parent to the needs of the child. And what we know is that, you know, there are a number of resources that can be brought in to support children. And there are a number of strengths or protective factors that parenting capacity assessments may overlook. So things like connection to community, connection to culture, a parent's openness and, you know, ability to engage other members of their support networks to meet the diverse needs of their child. So if we're looking only at the, you know, at this Western definition of a family, as Barbara mentioned, and in the moment, you know, sort of these assessments are really examining how a parent interacts directly with their child, and there isn't that space to look at the broader context in which that parent and child live, we're really missing the full picture. And, you know, clinically, what that means is we're missing opportunities to sort of build on those other supports and to sort of really shore up those protective factors. And I think, you know, that's where there's this big concern that parenting capacity assessments are missing the mark.
So Genevieve, when we look at the literature, can we say, do parenting capacity assessments work and for the general population? And what do we know about whether they work with First Nations families?
So it's a good question. It's not exactly an easy question to answer in terms of what literature is out there. First of all, there's actually quite a lot of variation in terms of the different assessment methods and tools that can be used in parenting capacity assessments. So that makes it kind of difficult to compare the results and really evaluate their use in terms of their impacts. And as I said, you know, just the concept itself of parenting capacity is not very clear or well-defined.
So it sounds like kind of a bit foggy. So if I was a parent and I'm sitting there and somebody says to me, I need to have a parenting capacity assessment, or if I'm a professional working in a First Nations community along with that parent, or I'm a parent advocate, what are some of the questions I should be asking about this parenting capacity assessment before I agree to go down that road?
I would be asking is, how is that tool or process going to illuminate my parenting? So are these tools that take into consideration definitions of family, of my family and community, or are these tools that are based on Western Eurocentric views of family and community? Are there culturally appropriate tools embedded in this process? And where is that evidence that these are tools that are going to give me some good feedback around my parenting? Have you ensured that there aren't inherent biases in these processes? And how is this going to interrupt colonial child welfare practices that largely ignore intergenerational trauma on First Nations peoples?
Yeah, and these questions are really important to ask because the implications of being found to be unfit as a parent by one of these can be really life-changing for you and for your child. Dr. Vandermoors, what other advice would you give to a family who's been said, hey, look, we want to send you off for one of these parenting assessments?
You know, a family should have the opportunity to understand as best they can what this is going to entail. You know, I think in addition to the fact that these types of assessments run the risk of sort of continuing colonial child protection sort of processes and sort of re-perpetuating trauma, the way in which they're actually done should ideally come from a trauma-informed perspective. So how the capacity assessment is actually sort of undertaken should be done in a way that attends to the lived experiences of the parent with whom they're engaging. So I think, you know, for a family, understanding what the assessment entails, how it's going to be interpreted, is there an opportunity for dialogue around that interpretation? Is there an opportunity to bring in those other strengths and resources and protective factors for that child so that if an assessment is going to be done, it's done in a fulsome, holistic way that really does still center the child and the child's needs, but really thinks more broadly about how those needs are being met or could be met.
Is it fair to say, and I know this is kind of a simple characterization, but if I presented myself at the doctor, usually they don't just send me for one test. There's lots of tests that I'll go through to kind of put together a story about what might be happening. So a parenting assessment, it seems to me, it's one part of the story that people should be asking questions. But is it fair to say it should not be the tool upon which you make a decision about whether to remove a child on its own?
Absolutely. Particularly for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples, there's no evidence that it's an appropriate way to assess parenting in and of itself. but the context of the parenting always should be considered when you're making a decision about what is in the best interest of a child.
Now, I just want to give you all an opportunity to kind of give us one of your key takeaways about parenting assessments, about what our listeners should know. So, Genevieve, we're going to begin with you. You've been plowing through all the literature for us. What is the big takeaway that you would send out to listeners about what they need to know about parenting assessments?
The main takeaway, just to summarize everything that we've been saying, is that parenting capacity assessments in their existing form, they may not be appropriate for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit families because they're based on these Western philosophies. They're normed on non-Indigenous families. This can be very problematic because in this way, they're using, you know, what's seen as an incorrect standard to really assess the capacity of a First Nations parent to parent their own children. So just in other words, you know, you really can't make a valid assessment of a parent's ability in their own role if you're using standards as a base of comparison that aren't even relevant or meaningful to them.
All right. Thank you. Dr. Fallon?
Yeah, just to add to Genevieve's observation that parenting is certainly a vital and important consideration when judging, you know, the best interests of the child. But a parenting capacity approach or understanding someone's parent in relationship to the child, as Dr. Vandermore said, really has to include approaches to formulating and administering and evaluating those parenting assessments that include First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples.
And it seemed to me that there would be a lot of child development in this too, right? Like, I mean, you know, you start off with a baby, they got their own challenges and wonderful things about them, but it's very different when you're parenting a teenager. Dr. Vandermorris, what is your kind of takeaway on these parenting assessments?
You know, what Genevieve and Barbara have summarized is really spot on. And I think the other piece is, you know, I guess from a pragmatic or, you know, where we are right now standpoint, if these are going to continue to be used in the short term, I think we really need to advocate for training for those who are administering them to better understand the limitations of a parenting capacity assessment, to really implore those who are conducting these parenting capacity assessments to consider the bigger picture and to really challenge the system to reflect on how we can better sort of incorporate the diversity of teachings of and approaches to child rearing into our considerations of how to, you know, best support each individual child.
It almost sounds like we need a societal capacity assessment. Like, why aren't we doing things that, you know, like a universal basic income, making sure there's quality early childhood care? Why aren't we doing things around making sure that people have access to addressing collective trauma? All of these things are needed in order for parents to succeed, especially those who have been in the wake of colonialism, versus just simply looking at the parent in isolation of all those factors. This has been really helpful to me to understand these parenting capacity assessments. And it also has helped me kind of understand some questions that I might ask if I'm an advocate of a parent, or I'm a parent myself and I'm being asked to undertake one of these. And I also would put a shout out to the judiciary. I think this is something very, very important that all members of council and those who make decisions in child protection cases should be aware of, is where these things come from, that there isn't a lot of cultural validity for their use, and that we need to be very cautious about their use and application for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples, and use them if they're going to be used as one tool in a broader toolbox. I want to thank you all for your contributions today. We'll join you next time. Thank you to my guests for this wonderful conversation. Thanks for joining us on this episode of Spirit Bear's Ask an Expert podcast. Be sure to tune in for more episodes coming up where we'll do this all again and find out what works for kids. And of course, you can find us on Twitter at Caring Society or visit our website, fncaringsociety.com, where you can get all kinds of information about this topic and our future episodes.